Welcome, everyone. You're listening to KPFA International Women's Day programming. In this hour, you'll have the chance to hear a conversation among three Bay Area feminist faith leaders who are devoting their lives to creating a just and truly secure world where all life will thrive. I'm Margot Okazawa-Ray with Jihan Hakim, Reverend Deborah Lee, and Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb. I first became interested in exploring the topic of feminist faith-based leadership after watching Rev. Deborah in action. Before then, like many other academics, I'd written off organized religion because of its horrendous history of justifying and participating in colonization, genocide, and slavery, and its deployment to justify racial and gender-based violence. I also remember, especially my students of color, becoming ambivalent about their religious backgrounds and their faithfulness to religious practices and beliefs that had helped them and their families stand resolutely in face of exclusion and oppression. As I was preparing to record this show, I realized, of course, that the liberation theology of Dr. King and others like him deeply influenced the Black Civil Rights Movement, which made it possible for me to attend university. I also remembered that I had come from a family of AME ministers, and I was raised a Buddhist, so I do have religion. The purpose of our conversation is to give skeptical listeners a chance to reconsider and to make visible and to showcase the important role that feminist faith leaders play in transforming our communities, our societies, and ourselves. Welcome to International Women's Day at KPFA, Jihan, Debbie, and Lynn.
My name is Jihan Hakim. I'm a Bay Area native, so born and raised in San Francisco. I'm on the board of Interfaith Council of Alameda County, ICAC, so I think that's where we probably have seen each other, Rabbi Lynn. And I chair the Yemeni Alliance Committee, which is a grassroots organization that works on foreign policy. And I'm Muslim. And I've also been on the Meet a Muslim panel. So that's kind of, and I'm a mom. I'm a mom of four. So pass it over to Reverend Deborah.
I'm Reverend Deborah Lee. I'm the director of the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity, which is a statewide interfaith organization, works on social justice issues. I'm a mom also, but most of my kids are grown. And I'm a United Church of Christ minister. I think those are my basics.
We sometimes have a ceremonial way of introducing ourselves. And as people of faith, as women of faith, it has been very meaningful for me to say that I am Miriam Bat Sivia Bat Bessie Bat Delia Bat Jenny Bat Henrietta, who came to Turtle Island, Eastern Pennsylvania in 1839. And I'm her descendant. I'm a first generation of women to become rabbis in the United States and pretty much more or less in Jewish history. Right now I serve as chair of Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity. And I wear a bunch of other hats too.
So let's begin. Can you each speak about your own faith background and what is it like being a woman in leadership in your respective religious affiliations?
So I think contrary to what a lot of folks believe about Islam, woman and leadership isn't an oxymoron. I think these problems have risen when the catalyst of feminism is being defined by a certain segment of the population with a certain metric that defines freedom. And it almost forces other women into that box as if that type of feminism is the only pathway towards freedom. In Islamic history, for example, there have been many women leaders, teachers, matriarchs, even within my own family, who have taught me how to lead with virtue, with righteousness, and to always be mindful of my creator. The Sharia, for example, which is Islamic law, regards women as a spiritual and intellectual equal of men. It is within our right to lead. It's really about women realizing our inherent and divine truth and putting in the work and having our allies allowing space for a Muslim woman to lead. And others should follow as well. So whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim, to follow the lead of Muslim women that are, you know, doing this kind of work, fighting for justice.
Yeah, so Lynn, you were the first, you said practically the first in the world, woman rabbi. Can you talk maybe historically or what that was like for you?
Yes. First, I really want to appreciate what Jehan said, because when we ask this question in general, it has such a Western Christian view. And I want to honor the strength of women in my own culture throughout time in various times and places. Today is a story of Queen Esther and Vashti, you know, who said no to the empire, to being objectified. So this is an ancient story we tell. On the other hand, Judaism has also evolved within its own and surrounded by different kinds of patriarchy. And one of those had to do with women not taking the role of rabbi. Even though women were in leadership, there were certain things that were excluded, being counted in a prayer minyan, chanting in public in Hebrew, and being a judge, basically. So it had less to do so much with being a spiritual person or capable of learning or anything else, but it had to do with whether women qualified as witnesses. And this is where the sexism comes in. There have been precedents for women rabbis, and I'd like to recognize Asnat Barzani, who lived 1590 to 1670, because she was a rabbi in Kurdistan. And her story and other stories of women who did take on that role are quite special. As for me, if this were visual, the thing that really sticks out the most, because I was such a little kid when I got started, I call myself in the days when I was a baby rabbi, you know, I'm in my early 20s and I looked younger and I have very long hair, and people would say, what do you do? And I'd say, you know, I'm a rabbi. And they'd look me literally up and down from head to toe, looking at my face, looking at my body and say, are you a woman rabbi? And so I would take my very long hair and I would position it under my chin so that I had a beard, and I would say no. And then I would take it away and say, oh yes. So a lot of it was around just getting used to see a woman step into that position. And it did seem generational as well, although not exclusively. Once a 93-year-old woman who survived the Shirtwaist Triangle factory fire joined my congregation when she was 93. And I asked her why, and she said, I was waiting for a woman rabbi. So, yeah, I think the community in this moment accepted women in that role for the most part, 85% of the community.
I would like to have met that woman. Debbie.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, for me, there's a lot of contradictions that I had to overcome. And I think, you know, being Christian in the United States means you carry the weight, you know, you carry the weight of the role Christianity has played, the interconnection of Christianity and white supremacy on religious supremacy, you know, not to mention the sexism, not to mention the homophobia, you know, that gets so much of what's projected out gets tied into Christianity in this country. And so I think that those were things that, you know, were probably bigger challenges for me than just the gender piece. There was definitely a gender piece around my own internalized sexism about, oh, you know, is this the kind of leadership, you know, should I be in a recognized leadership position? What does it mean to have, especially someone who's progressive, and you kind of think, how do we feel about hierarchical structure in the first place? So why would we want to have that kind of hierarchy, you know, fall into that hierarchy? But I think for me, the biggest, and I maybe I'll just connect to my own journey around these contradictions. I grew up in an immigrant family, and I do think that for immigrant families, faith is very important, whatever faith that is, because a lot of times you come, you don't have extended family. You know, one of the few things you bring around your culture and your identity is your faith. And for my family, you know, we were very alone in Ohio, Margo, we both came from Ohio at some point in our lives, and, you know, very isolated. And I think faith was a real way to connect to community. So I think when people discount faith, I want people to remember that, you know, for immigrants, for people who are struggling with addiction or struggling with issues of violence, incarceration, you know, faith is sometimes one of the few things that help them carry through and get on with that. I think for myself, I had to wrestle with the religion I grew up with. And this is maybe for a lot of your students too. You kind of grow up with a certain religion, and at some point you have to wrestle with it and make it your own. You have to make it make sense for yourself. And you have to like figure out, how do you live with the contradictions that exist? You know, for me, it was around white supremacy. It was this idea of religious supremacy. I have family living in other parts of the world, and the kind of Christianity that I experienced in the United States was one that, you know, felt that people in other parts of the world didn't matter. You know, they were dumb, they were stupid, they were, you know, they needed to have the Bible or they wouldn't matter, you know, they wouldn't count. So that contradiction was very clear to me around both the interfaith aspect. Many of our families are interfaith, and so the ways we talk about one religion being better than another, or the United States being better than other countries, and then the issue of racism and sexism, you know, were other things that stood out to me in the biblical tradition that I thought, I just can't buy into this. I can't agree with this. And it was a process of really finding Christians who were part of a liberatory strand of religion. And perhaps every faith tradition has this. You know, you can have a version that's very oppressive, but you could also have people who found lines of interpretation and lines of practice that are about liberation, and able to kind of bridge those contradictions.
Yeah, and you know, as I'm listening to you, I'm remembering also that, you know, cultures were there long before formal religion. And in some ways, I've heard feminists in other parts of the world talk about how the patriarchal cultural practices were justified using, you know, religion. And, you know, the religious leader, patriarchal religious leader saying, this is what the holy book says about women, right? When it's really a politicized religion, right, rather than the faith and the original teachings of the religion. Am I getting something right here?
I guess we feel a little, that's, I think, more in a Christian context, because in our culture, we criticize the Torah all the time. In fact, sometimes we use the Bible against itself. So we have this sense of evolving thoughts about our sacred text, in which values are really important, and the text is actually measured by values, which is interesting, you know, to think about, because it means that if the value is a life is sacred, then it's, you see, like the perspective on capital punishment in Jewish life, in which there's capital punishment in the Bible. And so when we hear people using the Bible to justify capital punishment, Jewish people think, well, the rabbinic tradition, which is much closer to where we are now, basically said capital punishment is an abomination. So that, I think it's important to understand too, that it's not so much for us about going back to an original innocence, but to keep struggling with the things that need healing and need reform and need transformation. Some things, you arrive at a certain moment in history and you see certain practices which once were normative are harmful and hurtful because there's greater information. And I think I feel I owe a lot, my community owes a lot to the struggle of Black people in the United States in the 60s in particular, which opened up a whole new liberatory idea of what religion could be.
I think, Lynn, though, there are aspects of religion, I don't know about Judaism, but people who say, well, they don't want things to change. And they want to say, we're not evolving in a certain way. And sometimes where the stuck points are where it's convenient to cultural bias or convenient to homophobia, you know, other ways that people are thinking more because of the culture, but where the religion can reinforce and back that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my point. I mean, you know, I heard this a lot when I was living in Palestine, you know, and the women's rights activists talking about the ways in which political Islamists who were using Islam to justify certain kinds of oppression against women or other discriminatory practices. Jihan, you want to add anything to this point? You know, the ways in which traditional cultures, way before formal religious practices and institutions were created, are justified using religion. And then, you know,
I definitely agree that religion or whatever we call this democracy or the constitution, a lot of different pieces of legislation, whether they be divine or man-made, have been used against people. And they've been, used to justify war crimes, essentially, in the United States and around the world. And it's really unfortunate. And a lot of times, those that are perpetuating these insert oppression, whatever they are, they tend to be men and men of power. So unfortunately, that's been a common theme, which is why it's so important for women of faith to lead in a way that's much more holistic and mindful of those who oftentimes are the victims of these politicized agendas, which are women.
I'm listening to you all and you sound so amazing and powerful. And I know I've seen some of you in action. I'm curious though, how did you even come to do this work? To think of yourself as a leader from a particular religious tradition, and you know, why did it matter to you that you do it that way, that you be a change agent that way, rather than the usual way that progressive people do, which is in a very secular way?
I can jump in. I really don't like the word leader, to be honest with you. I oftentimes am called that, but I'm really just a humble servant of the Lord. And if I can quote scripture, in the Quran, chapter number 4, verse number 135, where God says, "O you who believed, be persistent, stand firm in justice, even if it be against yourselves, even if it be against your parents, your relatives, whether they be rich or poor, Allah is more worthy." That tells me really that the Quran points to justice as a pillar of our faith. And complacency was never part of Islam, whether it be elevating our level of spirituality on a personal level, because I think that's something that I also struggle with, or be it fighting against policing borders or endless wars. Seeking justice and creating change is an innate part of my faith. So naturally, this is why I do what I do, because I serve God through serving his creation. So I don't know if it's all of the above or being a woman, but really just this is my calling. So I just... Not a leader. I'm just a servant of the Lord.
Well, I love that that sense of humility and devotion. It's very beautiful. And I came in this moment when in my culture, elders, rabbi, male rabbis called me to be a rabbi several times, different times. And it was kind of a unique calling. The first time was when I was 14 and I had just given a sermon on, I guess I've always been kind of the way I am. You know, it was a sermon on heartbreaking war in Southeast Asia and racial genocide here, which I had seen with my, you know, and traveling through the South and and then the Holocaust, you know, I mean, it's a lot. The world is a lot to take in, especially having grown up in a kind of privilege, but realizing things, you know, are sort of all around you, and wondering, knowing that your own relatives, that there are people in your community who survived genocide, and just not knowing, you know, where things stop and start exactly, and being called by elders to serve, that it's a kind, it's very overwhelming. And then in that context, traveling to Palestine and realizing that the elders who are deeply involved in the civil rights, saying that we should think of the Holocaust as never again for anyone. And then seeing early on 1966 and seeking out Palestinians who would share their stories with me, and realizing that was my real loss of innocence. Any innocence I had of sort of being an innocent victim, part of a people that's innocent in history, came in learning the stories of Palestinians. And then sort of realizing Jewish accountability, white Jewish accountability in issues of racial equity, and then issues around feminism and violence against women and gay and trans people, you know, because as a woman rabbi, being one of the first people who were outside of the norm, the projected norm, would come to me seeking something that they weren't getting from men. And that made me very aware across the board of the realities of my community are different than what's projected. I don't know if that had to do with, you know, the 50s in suburban America or what exactly, but, and how widespread it was, but it certainly impacted me in thinking about what it means to be a spiritual a rabbi in the Jewish community, and what my relationship is also to other people who are coming to me, not in my community, also seeking a woman in spiritual leadership.
I think what you're getting at, Lynn, is, you know, different ways that women lead and different ways that we are provide faith leadership. I think, Jehan, you think, oh, I'm not a leader, but I think of you as a leader, because I follow you. I will follow you, you know, and, you know, you've led so much consciousness and awareness around Yemen. And really, I see your leadership being respected in the community. And so I think that it points to this other ways of, like, feminist ways of leading that doesn't look like that certain kind of patriarchal leadership. And there's a yearning for a different kind of leadership. There's a yearning. People want to be led in a different way that's not power over, but empowering and co-powering with others. And so I think that that's really something we contribute. I think there's so many women in faith leadership now than when I began seminary. And I didn't go to seminary to become a faith leader. I went to seminary because I wanted to study my faith. I wanted to understand it better. And I didn't want to become a faith leader. Actually, I felt I was called to take that step actually by young people. And it was young immigrant girls who were in traditions and cultures in which they could not be ordained, even if they had that dream inside them, who asked me to do it, you know, and to push me to do it. But I wanted to answer, Margo, your question about, you know, why did we go this path? Like, I think there was a time where I was just a secular activist. I was doing a lot of education about globalization, neoliberalism, the economy. I think I was a pretty good community teacher, but I realized that it was not knowledge, that knowledge did not change people. They could have so much, we could be doing workshops after workshops, studies, research, reports, all of that. That did not necessarily move people to change. And I realized that what moved people to change was really the heart. And so to me, the spirituality and faith was a way to, like, get at people's hearts. These ways that we close down our hearts, like, how will we open our hearts? How would we see compassion? How would we see brothers and sisters among other people and bridge those divisions and divides? I realized, okay, I think that's the key. That was my calculation. I was like, I think that's the key. And I want to be in a zone that's working at that level. I mean, of course, you have to have the head stuff, but you also have to have the heart moving stuff.
Jihan and Lynn, how do you think people change? How did you change? This is a question I ask myself all the time. All the information in the world is not going to change people who are deeply embedded in something else.
Thank you first, Reverend Deborah, for saying those kind words. I'm touched. You almost made me cry, but I'm going to not. You know, I often refer to scripture, honestly. And I think when I think about change, I think about chapter number 13, verse 11, where the Lord says, "Verily, the Lord does not change a condition of people until they change what is within themselves." And I think what this verse tells us is two things, is that one, we must change ourselves. And it also tells us that God knows that we can. He knows that we can change. We have all the mental faculties, emotional, you know, physical. I mean, even despite for those with, you know, disabilities, that God knows that we can. So we must have faith that we can. And it's a process. Faith isn't a switch. You know, it goes up and down. It's in phases. Sometimes we're stronger in faith, and other times our faith is tested. Just like with any change, consistency is key. So continuing to practice, continuing to pray, read scripture, meditate, establishing a connection with our Creator, I think is how people change, and having faith that the Almighty loves us all. And when you love someone, you want to maintain a connection with them, to draw closer to them. So I think that's the first step, is just really seeing ourselves and seeing that we are worthy of love, and we're worthy of, and we're capable of change, and God has faith in us, so have faith in ourselves. And I think that's sometimes removed, you know, there's this really sense of low self-worth, unfortunately, in the world because of so many different things. I mean, you know, I think we can point to a lot of state violence when we look at why people don't have faith in themselves. But I think that we have to, or I remember that God has faith in me. So why don't I have faith in myself? Just, you know, having that consistency, having that reflection, pondering why we're here and what is our purpose. I think all of that really creates change within ourselves. And then once the change has been shifted within ourselves, I think there's a sense of power that no one can stop us, because we are with the Lord of the world. And then we can create change. We can just create a lot of change because we have that sense of content, you know. And I think that's what the world is really missing, is that the Lord accepts us the way we are, and we can walk with Him and move the world with Him.
When I started to engage in change in my community, I engaged two cultural medium. Storytelling, because storytelling is such an amazing way to go at something where you're not sort of hitting a person in the face with it, but it's almost like you're serving something very sweet and people are eating it. And then all of a sudden it starts to fill you in this different way, and you have this wonderful experience. You're like, ah, I can see something different now. And, you know, it's a very healing and wonderful and spacious way to allow people to come to a different kind of understanding through loving engagement rather than morality or sort of fear or shaking your finger at someone. The other is a ceremony. We actually have a tactic, a strategy for communal change, which we call tshuva. In which we have five steps that, which have served me well in thinking about strategic change, which is truth telling. Well, first softening the heart, just so that, you know, people can accept coming together to listen to each other, to listen to stories, and then hearing where the wound is. Being tshuva is about listening to where a wound lives inside people, and reflecting on what accountability looks like, as, you know, trying to create a culture of repair and healing, and taking a collective view of that, like we doing it together, honoring some kind of reparations, so that change is systemic and social, because one individual, it's a lot to carry, you know? And so we see it as more of a collective effort, which is why I love, for instance, Interfaith Women for Human Integrity, where we're we're bringing our values together and we're creating spaces for people to soften their hearts, to hear testimony from people who are experiencing violence in society and what that looks like, to hear the nature of way things can change, and then to use our platforms as religious people to call to our communities who have religious values to engage, and then to look at what does it mean to have the harm not persist. I think of change as movement building. When 9/11 happened, we immediately opened up the community doors and 100 Jewish people came in New Mexico where I was. And we went around the circle and people spoke for 30 seconds each. There were a lot of people there. And we had this bell that we kept ringing as people finished. And each people said two things. It was amazing. Everybody had a relative in New York. That was one thing. And two, people were really afraid that we would go to war. And I realized in this community, there was a feeling that we should do something different. And we were inspired by Junsan of the Hiroshima Peace Walk, the Mihoji Buddhists, in their walk of witness against atomic energy and for indigenous solidarity. We were inspired to walk between Jews and have a Jewish Muslim peace walk. And we did this in April, and we took that walk to the Muslim community in part to walk through neighborhoods and to have people on the ground to talk to each other and to get to know each other. And I guess that was sort of a ceremonial way of appreciating each other's culture and finding ways we could be in solidarity with each other. And that to me is also a really important element of change, that we get to know each other, not just for the purpose of understanding each other, but for the purpose of ending violence.
You are listening to International Women's Day programming on KPFA. I'm in conversation now with four truly inspiring, moving women of faith. Some describe themselves as leaders. Some say a servant, being of service. I think all of you are being of service and all of you are leading.
One of the ways we believe change happens is this idea of encounter. I think, Lynn, you were alluding to that. And for me, some of the theological roots of that, you know, come from my understanding of Christianity. You know, stories of Jesus, he was very tactile, touching the sick, healing people, feeding people. You know, there was something about bridging taboo, stigma, separation, and coming across those lines to have encounter, real encounter, and seeing the sacred in the other, seeing the other as a mirrored reflection of yourself and seeing your own humanity in the other person. So part of the ways that I think change happens is when we're able to do that. I think of so much, we think a lot about the criminal justice system and talk to a lot of people who find themselves in the criminal justice system and the root causes of crime and how alienated they felt. Often they felt how alienated, how out of touch with their own humanity they were, their own sense of dignity, which led them to then, you know, harm somebody else and violate somebody else's sense of dignity and sacredness. And I think that part of what faith practice, maybe spiritual practice and communal spiritual practice can do is help us restore our sense of humanity. We're living in a system, you know, it's so dehumanizing, you know, the capitalist system that we live in. Now we're like on Zoom all day under COVID. You know, it's really hard to feel really human. You know, where you're stressed, you're trying to do everything. And so how can those spiritual practices and communal practices help restore our higher selves, our true selves, and how we can be connecting to people that we've been forced apart from? We've been forced to think they're different, they're other, they're no good, and really bringing together this sense of beloved community.
And then another conversation, I heard you, Debbie, talk about remembering. If you take apart that word, it's putting the membrane back together somehow, right? And that speaks, I think, to something you're saying about how do we reconnect with one another, and not just on the physical level, you know, like we see each other getting off Zoom, you know, we're having dinner together, but really I'm hearing both at the heart level and a deep spirit level that's really intangible, except that you can feel it. You know, it's both intangible and very tangible. And I like how you talked about Jesus being tactile. Yeah. What's on your mind? I mean, I'm just so just blown away by this conversation.
You know, a lot of us work for organizations and there are benchmarks and grants that we have to fulfill and a lot of boxes that we have to check. You know, how do you incorporate faith work to a space where it's all transactional? And I think for me, deep down inside, outside of all the reports that I have to submit, what really fills me is not that I got the grant or that we were received some kind of whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. Is that what we're doing is work that is not commendable in the world, right? It's not, you can't really measure it and you can't, you're oftentimes not rewarded for it because it's the work that goes unseen and unrecognized because it is for the creator of the world. And you're, like I said, you're serving humanity. So I think for me, you know, all of the benchmarks don't matter as long as I am doing the work, which I believe the Lord sees. And one day that we will be rewarded for all the things that people that don't see, because oftentimes we, you know, that there's a saying in Islam where if you see something, you have to change it, whether it be with your hand or within your mouth, you'd be vocal about it. Or if you have the weakest of faith, you pray for it in your heart. So all of these different practices, we believe that the Lord of the heavens and earth will reward us for. And I think that gives me so much comfort. And it doesn't even feel like work because only God sees it. You know what I mean? And God will reward it one day after everything is said and done. And it's going to be much larger than whatever grant that we can apply for.
Can I say something? Of interconnectivity, because, you know, Jewish people are less theological in certain ways. We're known to have a sort of a lot of arguments with theology. There's a beautiful theological image of interconnectivity, of imagining the feminine presence as a web. This is a very ancient idea. You know, it's one of the oldest, maybe female imaginations, feminist imaginations, if you like, of all of life being connected. And if you can feel that interconnectivity with everything that's alive, that transcendent feeling of all of life being interconnected, then you realize if you harm one part of it, you're harming the whole. That's something that can be communicated across culture and faith and many different things, this sense of being connected. And I've really experienced that in the many travels I've done to, especially to Palestine, but also to Iran and to Indigenous America and other places, hospitality as a spiritual value that of just being willing to share, to put hostilities aside, to meet people, to greet people, to share your resources with them, and to make everybody feel like a beloved guest. And then that practice extends into one's daily life. You know, it has a ripple effect. And so you transform this culture of capitalism and colonialism and objectification into a culture of hospitality and welcome and sanctuary. And I think that for me is where my faithfulness is to that way of life.
That's beautiful, Lynn. I think that our faith traditions speak to the internal transformation, but it's also the external transformation, right? And that connection between the internal and the obligation to be, you know, I guess in my language, I'd say, you know, God isn't just about saving people one at a time. You know, I mean, God is about the structures and the systems, you know, calling us to change and transform the structures and the systems in society that are causing systemic harm, systemic oppression. And our being faithful means attending to that too, right? Attending to that level of transformation and speaking out about that. So I think that's where I get excited. I know for, you know, in Christianity, sometimes it gets so individualized. Oh, it's just my personal religion. It's just going to be here in this little box, but it doesn't have any relevance in the world, you know, political relevance in the world. And, you know, my, you know, reading of scripture, and a lot of that's based, of course, on the Hebrew scripture too, you know, that a lot was talking about the larger society, and that as people of faith, we live in this larger society and have to say something about it and have to help change and transform it.
Well, from what you've been saying, all three of you have spoken about the larger transformation that also needs to happen, right, as well as the individual transformation. And if you just listen to popular descriptions of each of the religions, you know, we would not really hear the structural change that, you know, that's required or that's kind of compelled, you know, if you are a person of faith. It's individual and it's seeing what's wrong. Jihan, you said, you see something, you do something, right? And that something isn't just singular individuals, but all the forces that are at work, creating the destruction in the first place. And I really like also the image of everything being connected. And something I've been asking myself and, you know, other people is, what if we really truly believe that our destinies are bound up together, like we share a common destiny, that we're part of that web that Lynn, you just described. And, you know, I said to you all in the beginning that one of the reasons for my being really interested in this topic is listening to my students. And as Debbie said a little bit earlier, that many of my students have been are immigrants, or they come from immigrant families. They come from oppressed communities. Many of the families come to a place where there is some other person, one other person there. They don't just choose a place on the map and say, oh, I'm going to Akron, Ohio, right? But they choose a place where there's some other, some semblance of community. And Debbie, you talked about, you know, religion and religious practices helping to cement that and being a place where people can find themselves and find people like themselves be together. And so, you know, if you were a teacher, like I have been in the classroom, and you're encountering young person who's having some questions, you know, about how they can be both faithful and the progressive activist, what advice would you give them? You know, and I'm talking now specifically about young women or trans women or LGBT women who, you know, have experienced the religious institutions as really being exclusionary, and not just exclusionary, but in some ways inciting violence against them, even their families.
I would say to move towards wholeness, and that you can integrate all those parts of yourselves. I know it's hard to believe that sometimes you're in one space and you have to turn off all these other, you have to turn off your faith, you have to turn off your politics, you know, and I think people, especially as young women, were often juggling those different spaces and negotiating, you know, how we can be. But I think the joy of becoming fully human would be to be able to integrate all those parts of yourself and your life. And I would say to them that the social movement, and if you look at social movements all over the world, people are bringing their faith. They're integrating their faith into the justice work, and they're not leaving it out. And faith is a sustaining resource. It's a sustaining, you talk about the Black freedom movement, you talk about the liberation struggles, the decolonial struggles in Latin America, that I'm familiar with, and the Philippines, really shaped by strong movements that integrated faith, spirituality, practice, ritual, self-reflection, those stories that mean so much to people, that those were part of what helped fuel people for struggles that often take generations to win.
Yeah, this is a hard one. only because I know what it's like growing up being a woman of color and trying to hold on to your faith in a society that is really trying to push you in a whole different direction, trying to fit you into a box. So, I mean, I think if I can say anything is that, all of us were there at one point, and we didn't get to this place of leadership or women of faith in leadership, except for after so many trials. And a lot of these trials are personal, and they're things that we go through in silence. So I want to reassure young women that they're not alone, that these struggles that they're facing internally are ones that we all go through, and we continue to go through. We continue to push back against the empire that is very anti-God, because the empire is anti-people. So it's a struggle, and it's a journey, and it's okay to not always be in a strong sense of faith. It's okay to not be in always feel like you are, have pride in yourself. But I think that you will, and we, as we all have, found a place that we can feel a sense of pride and dignity in our respective faiths. And with that, we have been able to lead. And I think once young women get there, and they will get there in God's will, that there is nothing that can defeat them. There's another quote that says, similar to what Rabbi Lin said, is that the believers are just like one body. And when one of the limb suffers, the whole body responds to it. So I encourage women to find a space that they can find the unity in community, and that when they are hurting, all of the other parts of the community, as the body does, will respond to it and help lift it up.
I love just the question in general, that we care about young people. I find myself a mentor. I'm a rabbi, so I find myself, there's just a lot of young women out there who I'm very grateful feel loved by me. And I feel like one thing I can do personally, more than even give advice, is just to love people. What I see is advising young women, first of all, to go toward what they love, just to really trust what is your passion, what, fills you with joy, with fire. Go for that. Let that be a kind of navigational pull in your heart, and just keep paying attention to it. And take care of yourself. Just take time for yourself. I feel that, there's so many demands on young people and people in general, that I'm grateful I come from a tradition that legislates Sabbath. And I feel every person could benefit from having Sabbath in their lives. Just healing yourself, doing what you need to take care of yourself in a healthy way, and to find allies that support you, that can accompany you, so that you don't have to be alone. There are allies out there, and learn to see them and recognize them and rely on them. So take your passion, believe in yourself. what you need to take care of yourself in a healthy way, and to find allies that support you, that can accompany you so that you don't have to be alone. There are allies out there, and learn to see them and recognize them, rely on them. Take your passion, believe in yourself, find people who love you and will love you, continue to love you and walk with you part of the way. Ask for help. That's so important. We need support of each other. We can't do this by ourselves.
Thank you very much. You know, and this is not a question that we came up with during our pre-conversation, but I was thinking about this as I'm listening to you. Was there ever a time when you lost faith, when you just, your faith just was tested, or you questioned it? Because right now you sound so clear and so sure and so confident.
I think when I was dealing with my, struggling with my contradictions over Christianity, I lost faith in the institution of religion. I said I wasn't even Christian for a while, but I never thought I lost faith personally, but I lost faith in the institutions. And I think probably a lot of people feel that way. They're disappointed, they're disillusioned. They've been hurt by the institutions, which are made up of people and all of our failings. So I think for me, it was realizing that, that my faith went deeper than the institution. It was deeper than that. And it was something inside that was speaking to my aliveness, and that nobody could take that away from me. And that, you know, it was important to be able to name it and articulate the faith that I believed in. What did I have faith in, actually? What did I have faith in, and be able to own that for myself? And
wow. You know, I can't say that there was a time that I necessarily lost my faith, as much as there was a time in the post 9/11 era, you know, I was looked at in a certain way because of my faith, that my faith was hijacked. My faith was politicized. And then my community on a global level was then completely persecuted and victimized, and continues to be, because of the war on terror, because of, you know, so many other factors, Islamophobia as an industry being systemic. So I wouldn't say that there was a time that I lost my faith, but that there was a time where I almost lost faith in just people, humanity, of people born in the 80s. So right after 9/11, I was already a practicing Muslim young woman, and I was actually pregnant with my first child. And I was harassed and physically assaulted. My strength strengthened during, my faith strengthened during that time more than ever before. You know, I feel like God was testing me. Are you going to hold tight and hold firm to what you believe is right? Or are you gonna, you know, wither? Or are you going to let go and let, you know, all the powers that be, whoever they are, and there are many on many sides, take over what you know to be the truth? So I was definitely tested at that time. And I think it continued to be tested, especially because I am in political advocacy spaces. I do a lot of lobbying. And I mean, I'm a visibly Muslim woman. I don't hide that. And I'm proud of it. But it's definitely tough because, you know, if I removed it and I had hair, I think I'd be treated much differently. And I do have hair. I think that's something a lot of people don't, they may not realize, you know, that there's hair under here. And we do take it off sometimes, especially when we're home. It's just something that we wear outside of the home. Yeah, definitely. So not losing faith, but definitely my faith constantly being tested. And I'm so grateful that I'm at an age and I have enough wisdom to own it and accept it and, you know, and just continue to push on. I think so many communities are struggling with so much. So I'm definitely not the only one. And a lot of women of faith are not the only ones struggling. Whatever your struggle is, it's I think we're all, going through it in one way or another. But I thank God that I have never lost my faith. And I just pray that I hold on to it really, like, it's my lifeline. But it definitely continues to get tested, especially because, like Reverend Deb said earlier, the country where my family migrated from is being just really tested right now by the empire, of course. And I think sometimes we can resort to, you know, why God? Why are you doing this? Why are you allowing this? But I redirect that question. And instead of asking that, I really just, I oftentimes ask myself, like, what can I be doing more? How can I serve more? And how can I be part of the change in order to relieve some of the oppression? So that perspective has helped me keep faith and maintain it.
There's so much to say about this. Very beautiful. I think more of my life is about accompaniment. It's not so much whether faith is tested for me, because you know, I've served so many people who've been through the Holocaust and witnessed things in Palestine that are deeply challenging in my relationship to Jewish people. So it's more like keep putting one step in front of the other and being steadfast to accompaniment.
You've just been listening to a conversation on feminist faith-based leadership with Reverend Deborah Lee, Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb, and Jihan Hakim, Bay Area leaders for justice and peace. Stay tuned for more International Women's Day programming on kpfa.org, KPFA 94.1 FM on your radio dial.